Dr. Glenn Coulthard recently visited Halifax, located in unceded Mi'kmaq territory, on January 12th and 13th, 2012. Coulthard is a member of the Yellowknives Dene and a scholar of contemporary Indigenous politics and political thought. He is an assistant professor in First Nations Studies at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Coast Salish Territory. He is a founding member of the Camas Books and Info Shop in Victoria and the Dachinta Center for Research and Learning in Yellowknives Dene Territory, as well as being a member of the Frank Paul Society. Coulthard has also participated in the Purple Thistle Institute. The second of two talks he gave during his visit is called Seeing Red: Recognition, Reconciliation, and Resentment in Indigenous Politics. It combines Indigenous and European political philosophies to argue that the present efforts by the Canadian government towards reconciliation and redress with Indigenous people, such as the ongoing Truth and Reconciliation Commission, fail to resolve many substantive issues. He suggests that Indigenous people's anger at past and present injustices can be a socially transformative force for both Indigenous and non-Indigenous communities in Canada.
Our greatest critics and commentators are men and women of resentment. Our revolutionaries are men and women of resentment. In an age fundamentally deprived of passion, they alone have the one dependable emotional motive. Constant and obsessive, slow burning but totally dependable. Through resentment, they get shit done.
Without further ado, Dr. Glenn Coulthard.
Today I'm going to share with you some thoughts that I've been generating on the question of reconciliation and the process of reconciliation, so reconciling the relationship between Indigenous peoples and the state here in Canada. It's based off of some work that I've kind of worked up into one chapter of a book project that I have forthcoming with the University of Minnesota Press. So this is my shameless self-promotion pitch. It's called Subjects of Empire. It emerged out of the research that I did with my own community and the theoretical work that I do on the question of what it means to recognize Indigenous peoples' rights here in Canada. So that's kind of my prefatory remarks. On June 11th, 2008, the Conservative Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen J. Harper, issued an official apology on behalf of the Government of Canada to Indigenous survivors of the residential school system. Characterized as the inauguration of what he termed a, quote, new chapter in the history of Indigenous, non-Indigenous relationships in Canada, the residential school apology was a highly anticipated and emotionally charged event. Across the country, Native and non-Native people alike packed living rooms, churches, community halls, and band offices to witness and pay homage to this so-called historic occasion. The following is an excerpt from Harper's apology, and I'll quote, "Mr. Speaker, I stand before you today to offer an apology to former students of Indian residential schools. The treatment of children in Indian residential schools is a sad chapter in our history. The Government of Canada now recognizes that the consequences of the Indian residential school policy were profoundly negative and that this policy had a lasting and damaging impact on Aboriginal culture, heritage, and language. The legacy of the Indian residential school has contributed to social problems that continue to exist in many communities today. In moving towards healing, reconciliation, and resolution of the sad legacy of Indian residential schools, implementation of the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement began on September 19, 2007. A cornerstone of the settlement agreement is the Indian Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission. This commission will be a positive step in forging a new relationship between Aboriginal peoples and other Canadians." And then he goes on to conclude with this absurd statement, "God bless all of you and God bless our land." A statement which technically is only rendered legible because of the success of the genocidal impacts of the residential school. Yeah, that's just ridiculous. Anyway, You'll get a sense that this paper is kind of a phenomenological exploration of my own anger and resentment, so at this precise apology. So you might get a, just keep that in mind as I blabber at you for the next 40 minutes. Since at least the early 1990s, a global industry has emerged promoting the issuing of official state-orchestrated apologies, advocating forgiveness and reconciliation as an important precondition for resolving the devastating social impacts caused by intrastate violence, state-perpetrated mass atrocity, and historical injustice. Originally, this reconciliation industry of state NGOs, human rights organizations, commissions of inquiry, and so on, was developed in national contexts which sought to undergo a formal transition from the violent history of openly authoritarian regimes to more democratic forms of rule, known in the literature as transitional justice. But more recently, these approaches have been exported to the relatively stable liberal democratic context of settler regimes like Australia and Canada, and to a lesser extent the US and New Zealand. In Canada, we have witnessed this relatively recent reconciliation politics converge with a slightly older politics of recognition, which advocates the institutional recognition and accommodation of Indigenous cultural differences as an important means of reconciling the colonial relationship between Indigenous peoples and the state. Political theorist Andrew Schapp explains the convergence of these two discourses well in the following quote. In societies divided by a history of political violence, political reconciliation depends on transforming a relationship of hostility into one of civic friendship. In such contexts, the discourse of recognition provides a ready frame in terms of which reconciliation might be conceived. So my talk today will critically interrogate the potential of building a post-colonial political relationship of peaceful coexistence out of a liberal politics of recognition and reconciliation. For our purposes here, then, a politics of recognition and reconciliation can be said to refer to those state practices which seek to reconcile Indigenous assertions of nationhood and sovereignty with settler state of sovereignty by accommodating Indigenous identity claims in some sort of renewed relationship with the Canadian state. As it is commonly understood, reconciliation refers to the act of restoring damaged or unhealthy relationships. Restoring these relationships often requires, we are told, that individuals and groups work to overcome the debilitating pain, anger, and resentment that often persists in the wake of being injured or harmed by a perceived or real injustice. In settler state contexts, truth and reconciliation commissions, along with state arrangements that seek to accommodate Indigenous identity-related differences, are viewed as indispensable mechanisms of healing and cathartic transformation. They're also seen as a means of evading the cycles of violence and revenge that can occur when societal cultural differences are suppressed and when negative emotions such as anger, contempt, and resentment are left to fester within and between disparate social groups. Although it is on occasion acknowledged that the so-called negative sentiments like anger and resentment can sometimes have both positive and negative effects, more often than not they are represented in a hostile light, as unhealthy, irrational, non-conciliatory, self-defeating, and even as socially pathological. So in this sense, you often get sentiments like anger and resentment set up as a foil to negatively illuminate the positive aspects that is supposed to be brought on by forgiveness and reconciliation. Recently, a number of scholars have suggested that, theoretically at least, the generally unfavorable manner in which sentiments like resentment get taken up in the transitional justice and pro-reconciliation literature owes much to Friedrich Nietzsche's foundational critique of ressentiment in his 1887 masterpiece, The Genealogy of Morals. There, Nietzsche characterizes ressentiment, and I'm just going to sound less pretentious and use resentment, as a poisonous, festering, and impotent mode of being that is entirely negative and reactive. Resentment is a pathologically other-determined orientation to the world, which for Nietzsche signifies the abnegation of freedom as an expression of self-valorizing, life-affirming action. What is wrong with resentment, explains the late philosopher Robert Solomon, is that it, quote, interferes with the good life as Nietzsche conceives of it. It is a life of reaction against external threats and slights, and therefore a life-demeaning and life-stultifying emotion. According to Nietzsche, the, quote, need to direct one's view outward instead of back to oneself is of the essence of resentment. In order to exist at all, the so-called man of resentment always first needs a hostile external world. He needs, physiologically speaking, external stimuli in order to act at all. His action is fundamentally reaction. In short, to be saddled with resentment is a slave-like condition for Nietzsche, which he associates with the weak and the pitiful. It is a form of scapegoating, of blaming others for one's own inability or unwillingness to affirm oneself through action. It is ultimately, then, an expression of both the slave's jealous contempt for the strength and power of one's master and of his or her impotent desire for what he liked to call an imaginary revenge. Now, Nietzsche refers to resentment as an imaginary revenge because for him it isn't born of deeds. It doesn't translate into action. It's just the creation of a hostile external threat which one just kind of lets simmer in this negative comportment of resentment and desire that's never acted on for revenge. Now, stripping Nietzsche's critique of its clearly elitist and conservative connotations and applying it to their respective analyses of contemporary social movements, academics like Wendy Brown and Saul Newman have both suggested that when otherwise radical and potentially transformative political projects become structured by the logic of resentment, they run the risk of reinscribing their own powerlessness into the very actions they undertake to achieve collective or social liberation. Excuse me. Wendy Brown, in particular, has applied this Nietzschean critique to the politics of recognition, claiming that when identity-based movements seek stake recognition as a means of ameliorating the pain and powerlessness that state power has itself inscribed into its subjects, they risk reifying the conditions required for their own subjection. In the following minutes, I want to briefly engage what I think is an important criticism in light of Indigenous peoples' struggles for recognition and self-determination in settler contexts such as Canada. In doing so, I will argue two points, both of which I draw at least partially from the work of the great anti-colonial social theorist, psychologist, and revolutionary Frantz Fanon. My first claim is that following Fanon's own critique of recognition politics, developed in his masterful 1952 text, Black Skin, White Masks, I want to challenge the increasingly commonplace, and not to mention misplaced, assumption that the colonial relationship between Indigenous peoples and the state can be reconciled at all via a politics of recognition. More specifically, I'll argue that instead of ushering in an era of peaceful coexistence, grounded on the ideal of mutual recognition envisioned by Hegel, or a nation-to-nation relationship envisioned by Indigenous peoples, the politics of recognition in its contemporary liberal form promises to reproduce the very configurations of colonialist, racist, sexist power that our people's demands for recognition have historically sought to unpack and transform. Second claim, in light of the politics of recognition's abysmal failure to deliver on its emancipatory promise of reconciliation, I suggest that what Nietzsche refers to scornfully as resentment is not only an appropriate and defendable, but also a righteous sentiment to uphold, given that Indigenous peoples are still subject to the ongoing violence and injustice of colonial rule, displacement, and dispossession. Indeed, I will go even further to suggest that under certain circumstances, critically embracing our individual and collective expressions of resentment, as opposed to a politics that prematurely stresses the moral superiority of a neo-colonial framework of forgiveness, reconciliation, and recognition, can play a cathartic, critically transformative role in the rehabilitation of ourselves as colonized subjects and in the radical reconstruction of decolonized indigenous ways of life. So those are my two claims, which I'm going to walk through with you today. So first, the problem of recognition. So rather than transforming the colonial relationship in any significant sense, I want to suggest that the hegemonization of the recognition-based approach to questions of indigenous state relations following the publication and eventual shelving of Canada's so-called white paper on Indian policy has simply prompted a shift in the operation of settler colonial power since 1969. In the two centuries leading to this historic policy proposal, which essentially called for the blanket assimilation of the status Indian population by unilaterally removing any sort of legal or political differences that distinguishes First Nations from other Canadians under the Indian Act. The reproduction of colonial power between our nations and Canada depended heavily on the deployment of state power geared around the genocidal effects of marginalization and assimilation. Any honest examination of the character of the relationship or Indian policy during this period will attest to this. This era witnessed Canada's repeated attempts to overtly uproot and destroy the vitality and autonomy of Indigenous modes of life through institutions such as residential schools, through the imposition of settler policies aimed at explicitly undercutting Indigenous political economies and relationships to and with land, through the violent dispossession of First Nations women's rights to land and community membership under sexist provisions of the Indian Act, through the theft of Aboriginal children via child welfare policies, which now the amount of people or children in non-Native care through the foster system has exceeded the amount of Native children that were stolen and forced through institutions such as residential schools. And through, of course, the wholesale or near wholesale dispossession of Indigenous people's territories and modes of traditional governance in exchange for administrative powers to be exercised over relatively minuscule reserve lands. All of these policies sought to marginalize our people and communities, with the ultimate goal being our elimination, if not physically, then at least as cultural, political, and legal peoples, or better yet, nations, distinguishable from the rest of Canadian society. These state-orchestrated initiatives reflect the more or less unconcealed, unilateral, and violent nature of colonial rule that existed during most of the 19th and 20th centuries. Now, recognizing that our people and communities have always resisted these repugnant and racist practices, it wasn't until after the emergence of widespread pan-Native resistance to the white paper's assimilation proposal, coupled with the recognition of Aboriginal title and the Supreme Court of Canada's 1973 Calder decision, that policies geared towards the so-called reconciliation of Indigenous land and political grievances began to come to the fore of public consciousness and policy. In the wake of these events, the colonial architecture that frames Indigenous state relations shifted from a structure that was primarily reinforced by policies, techniques, and ideologies explicitly oriented around the genocidal marginalization assimilation double to one that is now reproduced through a seemingly more conciliatory set of discourses and practices which emphasize the recognition and accommodation of our rights and our cultural distinctiveness. Regardless of this modification, however, the relationship between Indigenous peoples and the state remains fundamentally colonial to its foundation. Now, in unpacking precisely how colonial rule made this transition from a more or less unconcealed structure of domination to a form of what Foucault might call colonial governmentality that works through the limited forms of freedom afforded by state recognition and accommodation, I have found the work of Frantz Fanon profoundly illuminating. And I just want to put a caveat here. When I claim that the relationship or the colonial relationship has shifted one from kind of more overt violence to one that is reproduced through recognition, I don't mean to challenge the fact that it is neither profoundly violent in its effects on Indigenous peoples, or that option of force has not left the field or realm of possibility for state action entirely. It is not. When recognition doesn't condition subjects in the ways that are appropriate to the reproduction of colonialist power in Canada, then the first recourse is immediate and swift. The billy clubs come out, the army is sent in, and the state emerges at the fore of disciplinary power again, which is demonstrated in the fishing disputes here in 2000. Oka, like any time that Indigenous peoples assert themselves in ways that crack the status quo. So in his first book, Black Skin, White Masks, for example, Fanon offers a groundbreaking critical analysis of the positive relationship drawn between recognition and freedom in the master-slave dialectic of Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit, a critique which I claim is equally applicable to liberal recognition approaches to self-determination or Indigenous self-determination in Canada. Fanon's analysis suggests that in contexts where colonial rule is not reproduced through violence or force on its own, the maintenance of settler-state relations requires the production of what he liked to call over and over again colonized subjects. Namely, the production of the specific modes of colonial thought, desire, and behavior which commit the colonized to the very types and beliefs and subject positions that are required for their own domination. To paraphrase Stolo writer Lee Merrickle's words, if the colonial state can no longer justify killing us, we'll just have to learn to kill ourselves. Now, unlike the liberal appropriation of Hegel that continues to inform many recognition-based proponents of recognition and identity politics, I'm talking specifically about Charles Taylor, but it applies to many identity kind of multicultural types. In Fanon, attaining recognition of one's master, or in our case, the colonizer, isn't seen as a source of freedom or dignity by Fanon, but is instead cast as the field of power through which colonial subjects are produced and reproduced. This is the form of recognition, Fanon suggests, that, quote, Hegel never described. So at its core, then, Fanon's argument can be summed up something like this. When delegated exchanges of recognition occur in real-world contexts of domination, like colonialism, the terms of accommodation and recognition offered to the colonized usually end up being determined by and in the interests of the master in the relationship. This is what Fanon refers to as the structural problem of recognition in Black Skin. But this isn't the extent of the problem, because Fanon then goes on to identify or demonstrate how colonized populations begin to develop psychological, or what he liked to refer to, psychoaffective attachments to these structurally limited gifts of recognition. For Fanon, these ideological subjective attachments are essential in maintaining the economic and political structure of colonial relationships over time. This is the subjective dimension to the problem of recognition that Fanon identifies in Black Skin. In Fanon, then, we are essentially shown how the long-term stability of a colonial social formation relies as much on the internalization or interiorization of the forms of colonial recognition that are either imposed or bestowed on us by our settler state masters as it does on the exercise of pure force. Given the dual character of colonial power, Fanon is also quick to insist that any form of decolonial praxis on the part of the colonized people and or communities must address these two interrelated features of power. In Fanon's words, practices of decolonization must, quote, wage war on both levels, the structural and the subjective, the material and the ideational. Now, anyone familiar with the power dynamics that continue to shape the Aboriginal rights movement in Canada should begin to see the insights of Fanon here. It doesn't take much effort at all to unpack the seemingly endless ways in which the dominant approach to recognition has been co-opted by and constrained by the state, by the greed of corporate interests, by the courts, in ways that have posed little challenge to the colonial relationship that exists between our communities and the Canadian state. Take, for example, the last 30 years of Aboriginal rights jurisprudence in Canada. During this period, the Canadian Supreme Court of Canada, or the Supreme Court of Canada, has consistently refused to recognize our equal and self-determining status based on the court's adherence to precedent founded on the white supremacist myth that Indigenous societies were too primitive to bear fundamental political rights when we first encountered European powers on the continent. Indeed, the very notion of reconciliation that has been advanced by the Supreme Court of Canada is entirely dependent on this racist form of non-recognition. This is most evident in the Supreme Court's interpretation of the scope and content of those Aboriginal rights recognized and affirmed in Section 35(1) of the Canadian Constitution. As the court states in 1996 Vanderpeet decision, and I'll quote, "What Section 35(1) does is provide the constitutional framework through which the fact that Aboriginals lived on the land in distinct societies with their own practices, traditions, and cultures is acknowledged and reconciled with the Crown. The rights that fall within the provision must be defined in light of this purpose. The Aboriginal rights recognized and affirmed by Section 35(1) must be directed towards reconciliation of the pre-existence of Aboriginal societies with the sovereignty of the Crown." This, of course, begs the question, how does the High Court go about reconciling the pre-existence of Aboriginal societies with the sovereignty of the Crown? Easy. By fundamentally refusing that the Aboriginal societies in question had anything akin to sovereignty worth recognizing to begin with. Instead, what the court offers up is an interpretation of Aboriginal rights as cultural rights that can be infringed on by the state, so long as this infringement can be shown to further, quote, a compelling and substantial legislative objective. And what substantive objectives might justify infringement, according to the courts? In Delgama, British Columbia, virtually any capitalist economic venture can justify infringement, including, and I quote, "the development of agriculture, forestry, mining, and hydroelectric power, the general economic development of the interior of British Columbia, protection of the environment or endangered species, and the building of infrastructure and the settlement of foreign population to support these aims." So today, it would clearly appear, much as it did in Fanon's day, that colonial power will only recognize collective rights and identities of Indigenous peoples so long as this recognition does not throw into question the white supremacist legal, political, and economic framework of the colonial relationship itself. Now, the above example with the courts shows some of the structural, in this case, legal constraints that Fanon's work suggests Indigenous peoples can expect to encounter when they make claims for the recognition of our rights and identities against a racist colonial state. But what are we to make of the subjective or psychological features of colonial domination that Fanon speaks of? In his work, is his work equally relevant to the Canadian context in the psychoaffective or subjective respect? Regarding the punishing forms of racist recognition that have been drilled into the minds and bodies of our people through the church, residential schools, by cops, and by racist individuals and groups within the dominant society, I think the answer to this question is clearly yes as well. There have been too many studies to count, novels written and autobiographical narratives told, which have outlined in often gruesome detail the way in which these expressions of colonial misrecognition have saddled our people with self-hatred, depression, alcohol and drug abuse, and has resulted in enticed violent behaviors which we have directed both inwards towards ourselves and outwards towards others. However, similarly convincing arguments have also been made regarding the forms of institutional recognition that have been offered our communities through the courts, self-government agreements, land claim negotiations, and state-sanctioned forms of economic development. Taiyagi Alfred's work as a friend and mentor of mine, for example, has shown the state's recent turn to recognizing and accommodating Aboriginal rights to land and self-government has allowed it to shed, and I'll quote him here, the most onerous responsibilities of its rule while holding fast to the lands and authorities that are the foundation of its power. By redefining the colonial relationship without structurally transforming it, the liberal politics of recognition has served the imperatives of colonial capitalist accumulation by offloading many of the most costly and cumbersome features of colonial rule, while at the same time, and I quote Alfred here again, further entrenching in law and practice the real bases of its control. Like Fanon before him, Alfred suggests that the state has been able to facilitate this by advocating an ostensibly new and post-colonial set of relationships premised on the limited form of recognition that still structurally ensures continued access to Indigenous peoples' lands, labor, and resources by co-opting Indigenous peoples into becoming agents of their own dispossession. Like Fanon, then, for Alfred, contemporary colonialism governs through the limited forms of freedom afforded through recognition and accommodation. And this is my favorite quote. In the new relationship, writes Alfred, Indigenous peoples are still bound to another's power order. The rusty cage of colonialism may be broken, but a new chain has been strung around the Indigenous neck. It offers more room to move, but it still ties our people to white men pulling on the strong end. On to reconciliation now. So now I want to return to the second claim I made at the outset of my presentation, namely that given the utter failure of recognition to deliver on its emancipatory promise of reconciliation, I suggest that what Nietzsche refers to scornfully as ressentiment, or resentment, is a righteous sentiment to uphold, and subject position to embody, and B, that under certain circumstances, critically embracing our individual and collective resentment can play perhaps a cathartic, critically transformative role in the rehabilitation of our colonized selves and in the radical reconstruction of Indigenous ways of life and community. Taken together, I suggest that these two claims connect with two problematic assumptions that underwrite both Nietzsche's critique of resentment on the one hand, as well as many contemporary arguments that support a liberal politics of recognition and reconciliation. The first assumption relates to how both perspectives characterize resentment as hopelessly backward-looking. Resentment is often cast as the inability to come to grips with history. Nietzsche, for example, describes resentment as an expression of one's, quote, powerlessness against which has been. Resentment indicates a failure to let go, or in Nietzsche's terms, to forget. According to this history, to wallow in resentment is to deny one's capacity to move on, to literally, in Nietzsche's sense, get on with life. Anyone familiar with the reconciliation paradigm should immediately see some of the similarities here. All one needs to do is recall Prime Minister Harper's so-called apology to those who survived the genocide of the Indian residential school system. By focusing narrowly on the tragedy of residential schools, Harper's apology is able to frame reconciliation in terms of overcoming a, quote, sad chapter in our shared history. It is a way of transcending a painful legacy that has hampered our collective efforts to, quote, move on. Reconciliation is necessary to, quote, begin anew, so that Indigenous peoples can start to build, quote, new relationships together with non-Indigenous peoples, which is located now, conveniently, on our land. The problem with this formulation, of course, is that insofar as Harper's bullshit apology even implicitly addresses the question of settler colonialism, it does so, to paraphrase anthropologist Patrick Wolfe, as an event and not a structure. That is, it's a historical phenomenon which occurred at some point in the past, but which unfortunately continues to have some negative consequences for our communities in the present. By definition, however, there is nothing historical or temporal in the past sense about settler colonial rule. Settlers came and they didn't leave. Settler colonialism is a relationship that's characterized by ongoing domination. It's a relationship where power, in this case, interrelated facets, discursive and non-discursive, aspects of economic, gendered, racial, and state power, has been structured into a relatively secure set of hierarchical social relations that continue to facilitate the violent dispossession of indigenous peoples of our land base and of our self-determining authority. In this respect, Canada is no different than any other settler colonial power. In Canada, colonial domination continues to be structurally oriented around the state's commitment to maintain, through force, fraud, and more recently, negotiations over land and self-government, ongoing access to the land and resources that provide the material and spiritual sustenance of our societies on the one hand, and the foundation of capitalist development, state formation, and economic development on the other. In such a context, I suggest that embracing one's resentment is not only an entirely defendable position, but that is actually a sign of our critical consciousness, of our sense of justice and injustice, and of our awareness of and unwillingness to reconcile ourselves with the structure and symbolic violence that is still very much present and a part of our present lives. I sure as hell resent the persistence of Canadian settler colonialism, and I hold what I consider to be a healthy and appropriate amount of contempt for those people and institutions who are willfully complicit in its ongoing reproduction. The second problematic assumption I would like to challenge relates more specifically back to Nietzsche's characterization of resentment as an entirely reactive as opposed to active attitude. Recall that according to Nietzsche, one of the most perverse features of the so-called man of resentment is that in order to exist at all, he first needs a, quote, hostile external world. His very identity, his subjective core, writes Nietzsche, depends on external stimuli in order to act at all. His action is fundamentally reaction. Wendy Brown reiterates this concern in her critique of identity politics as a politics of recognition, which too often develops its, quote, righteous critique of power from the perspective of the injured, and in doing so fixes the social identities of both the injurer and injured instead of transforming the oppressive Manichaean relationship of the relationship itself. If freedom is first and foremost about self-affirmative praxis, then the other dependent character of a politics structured by the logic of resentment makes it, for these two thinkers, the ultimate form of self-enslavement. On this last point, I think that Fanon's work is again relevant. Rather than hopelessly fixing one's actions on attaining a conciliatory and never-coming form of recognition from the colonial state and society, Fanon argues that the pathway to self-determination instead lay in a form of personal and collective self-affirmation. Rather than remaining dependent on the actions of their oppressors for their freedom and self-worth, on that hostile external world that Nietzsche refers to, Fanon recognized that the colonized must instead struggle to overcome their colonial mentalities against the racist gaze and assimilative lure of state recognition. According to Fanon, it is this self-initiated process that triggers a change of fundamental importance in the colonized psychological makeup, and what he called the psychoaffective equilibrium. According to this view, the colonized must initiate a process of decolonization by first recognizing themselves as free, dignified, and distinct contributors to humanity. According to Fanon, the oppressed must begin to, quote, turn away from their master dependency, and to instead struggle for freedom on our own terms and in accordance to our own values. Unlike Nietzsche, however, I suggest that Fanon saw resentment as having a potentially critically transformative role in inaugurating this newfound subjectivity and praxis. Throughout The Wretched of the Earth, for example, Fanon repeatedly speaks of the colonized subject's anger, envy, and resentment to the colonizer, even their desire for revenge, in cathartic terms. For Fanon, these expressions of contempt and resentment represent the initial stage of the subject's coming to consciousness. You're now identifying a hostile external world, which prior to that was not identifiable because of the effects of interiorization or internalization. In this context, and the coming to consciousness results or can is the effect of the purging of colonial racism. And if approached critically and directed appropriately, an important caveat in Fanon, can help the colonized jolt themselves into, quote, an actional existence, as opposed to a reactional one, characterized by the form of resentment that Fanon recognized Nietzsche was so concerned about. And in the best case scenarios, Fanon saw these negative emotions as having the power to prompt the very forms of indigenous praxis that are required to uproot the structural colonial injustices that, that produce resenting colonized subjects in the first place. So by way of conclusion, I would like to paraphrase one remarkably clear-sighted commentator on the virtue of anger and resentment in relation to revolutionary politics. He writes, "Our greatest critics and commentators are men and women of resentment. Our revolutionaries are men and women of resentment. In an age fundamentally deprived of passion, they alone have the one dependable emotional motive, constant and obsessive, slow burning but totally dependable. Through resentment, they get shit done." Thank you. Merci.
You've been listening to a talk by Dr. Glenn Coulthard called Seeing Red: Recognition, Reconciliation, and Resentment in Indigenous Politics. Recorded in Halifax on unceded Mi'kmaq territory on January 13, 2012. Produced by Praxis Media Productions and the Halifax Media Co-op. Thanks for listening.